Hello, and welcome to our debut episode of Milbank in Conversation, a new podcast from the Milbank Quarterly. I'm Alan Cohen, editor of the Quarterly, and today I am chatting with Amanda Mowry of the University of Michigan and her colleague Rebecca Heffagy of the RAND Corporation. They are two of the authors of a recent Milbank research article that evaluated state opioid misuse prevention policies. As we know, there is an opioid crisis in the United States. Opioid misuse is a major driver of declining life expectancy, and treatment costs are consuming ever larger portions of both state government budgets and family resources. The need for good policies that prevent opioid misuse has never been greater. So let me turn to you, Amanda, first. What motivated you and your colleagues to undertake this review of evaluations of state opioid misuse prevention policies?
Thank you, first of all, for having us. We're really excited to be here today to talk about our paper and opioid misuse policy more generally. We were motivated to conduct this review for several reasons. State policymakers are implementing a myriad of interventions to address the severe consequences associated with opioid misuse, and researchers have responded to these state efforts by conducting evaluations to determine their effects, looking at a variety of different types of outcomes. And other researchers have responded by synthesizing evidence from these empirical evaluations into review papers that speak to the body of evidence on the effects of state policies. However, despite the existence of previous reviews, we determined that an updated review would be useful for a couple of reasons. The first is that, as I said, despite the existence of review papers, they emphasized that evidence quality remained quite low and that more research was needed to establish policy effects. And then the second reason is that over the past 5 years, we've seen a dramatic increase in the number of evaluations of state opioid misuse prevention policies. In fact, 41 of the 71 articles included in our review were published between 2016 and 2018. And so for those two reasons, we determined that an updated review would prove useful to both policymakers and researchers. We hope that policymakers can use our findings to help determine which interventions are associated with a sound evidence base, and then which policies still remain associated with some uncertainty. And then we hope researchers can use our findings to help direct research resources that aim to study the effects of these policies.
That would certainly be the goal. Thank you. Those are very interesting findings. Rebecca, let me turn to you. Can you expand on the role of state government in prescription drug oversight, and how does that relate to opioid misuse prevention policies?
Yeah, sure. So I really view states as the engines and the initiators of a lot of these opioid policies to try to address overprescribing, misuse, all of these root causes, although there are many others, to the opioid crisis and where we are. States were really the first movers. For example, we had about 1,300 state bills introduced from 2010 to 2016, about 500 of which became laws that were all in this opioid misuse treatment, et cetera, space. We had another about 2,000 bills that have been introduced just in the time since then, so 2016 to 18. So you can see this is an area where states have been extremely active. And they really are well poised for that for a couple of reasons. They have the primary responsibility to protect the public health, well-being, and social welfare of their citizens. So that's where they have the public health powers to really step in and regulate here. They also are responsible for regulating professional practice and medical practice. So to take some examples, in terms of primary prevention of opioid misuse, so that's really preventing the initial exposure to the drug. We've seen states do a lot of things in terms of limiting the nature of prescribing and even the volume. The idea behind that is to think about alternatives to opioids in treating pain, for example, and then limit the excess amounts of opioids that are going into people's medicine cabinets and then can be diverted to other uses. Also, states have the authority and have set up systems to monitor controlled substances and shared that information with prescribers and law enforcement. Those are called prescription drug monitoring programs so that we can better see what is going on and know what's going on and prescribe safely. Finally, they have been very active on the tertiary prevention side. So that's really, I think of that once a disease is full blown. So in this case, addiction, how do we manage the symptoms? How do we prevent really bad harm from happening to those people affected? So states have been the driving engines behind naloxone access and put enormous amounts of money towards that to reverse overdoses. Also, they have been leaders in treatment access, these medications that treat opioid use disorder.
Right.
And really making those more widely available as well. So states have lots of roles here, and they have been exerting those.
Given the lack of high-quality evidence, what conclusions do you feel you can draw about the effects of state policies on prescribing and dispensing opioids?
Absolutely. So interestingly, there were several policies that appear to reduce opioid prescribing. So we are able to make some strong conclusions in this area. There were three main policies that stand out. The first are drug supply management policies. And these are policies that limit the quantity and dosage of opioids that can be prescribed, or they impose limitations on the utilization management practices that public and private insurers can apply to different treatments for opioid use disorder. And the evidence in this area suggests that these policies achieve their intended effects of reducing prescribing of the targeted prescription, which in this case were high-risk opioids, while simultaneously increasing access to lower high-risk prescriptions. The second area of interventions that appears to reduce opioid prescribing are robust prescription drug monitoring programs. So PDMPs, as Rebecca said, are electronic databases that track controlled substance prescribing in a state. They can contain a variety of different types of provisions and vary across the country. But we were particularly interested in, and other researchers have been interested in this as well, are robust prescription drug monitoring programs. And we define robust PDMPs as PDMPs that contain provisions that are known or hypothesized to increase prescriber use and access of the prescription drug monitoring program. And so an example of such a provision are mandatory access provisions that require prescribers to query the database prior to prescribing an opioid. And what the literature on these robust PDMPs suggests is that they reduce opioid prescribing both compared to states without PDMPs and then PDMPs without these robust provisions. The final area of policies that appear to reduce opioid prescribing are combined interventions. And there were many articles that fell within this category, but there were several that looked at a series of interventions in Florida in the early 2010s that included law enforcement, pharmaceutical, and public health approaches, such as the implementation of a prescription drug monitoring program, as well as a law related to pain management clinics. And these are policies that impose administrative personnel, as well as other requirements on facilities that primarily treat chronic pain. And what the literature says on the effects of these policies is that they similarly reduce opioid prescribing, but particularly have an effect on high-risk prescribers. So in sum, our review revealed three intervention groups that reduce opioid prescribing, those being drug supply management policies, robust prescription drug monitoring programs, mm-hmm. and then combined interventions that include law enforcement, public health, and pharmaceutical approaches.
Great. What policy effects did you see when it came to patient behavior and patient health?
Unfortunately, we were unable to synthesize the effects of interventions on patient behavior and patient health related outcomes for a couple of reasons. And I'll start with patient behavior. So we were unable to synthesize the evidence in this area largely because very few articles looked at patient behavior related outcomes. So just to provide a quick example, one of the interventions included in our view are anti-doctor shopping laws. And these are policies that prohibit an individual from withholding from a provider that they received a controlled substance from another provider. There was only one study that looked at the patient behavior effects of anti-doctor shopping laws, and it observed no change in the use of former prescribers. Moving on to patient health-related outcomes, we similarly were unable to synthesize the high-quality evidence in this area, but unlike patient behavior-related outcomes, the reason varied by intervention. For example, there were two or fewer studies that evaluated the patient health-related outcomes of all the interventions that fell within the primary and secondary prevention categories, with the exception of PDMPs. There were many studies that assessed the patient health effects of PDMPs, but the outcomes varied greatly across the articles. For example, some studies looked at fatal and non-fatal overdose. Other studies looked at changes in hospitalization. Other studies looked at drug misuse, drug dependence. Studies varied in terms of the opioids that they were looking at. And so for the reason of diversity in outcomes considered, we were unable to synthesize across all of the different outcomes. And then finally, tertiary prevention policies, as Rebecca said earlier, is a particular area where we're very interested in understanding the patient health effects of these policies. And while our review revealed growing rigorous evidence assessing the patient health effects of these policies, there remains very few high-quality evaluations. So this is an area where we do encourage further research, the patient health effects of tertiary prevention policies.
Okay, on that point, where should researchers concentrate their efforts in the future?
There are many areas where we encourage researchers to further explore the effects of state opioid misuse prevention policies. The first area are on the unintended effects of policies that intend to reduce opioid prescribing. And so, as I said earlier, our review revealed three different interventions that reduce opioid prescribing. However, there's also growing evidence suggesting that policies that intend to reduce opioid prescribing may be associated with greater illicit opioid use, as well as greater circumvented opioid use. And so for this reason, we highly recommend researchers concentrate their efforts in studying some of these unintended effects on patient behavior and patient health. The second area where we hope researchers concentrate their efforts, as I just said, are on the patient health effects of tertiary prevention policies. And I'll quickly walk through where the evidence currently lies to compel why it's such an important area of future research. Mm-hmm. So our review revealed three different interventions that fell within the tertiary prevention category, those being naloxone access laws, Good Samaritan laws, and policies affecting opioid addiction treatment. So starting with naloxone access laws, naloxone is an opioid antagonist that rapidly reverses opioid overdose. And naloxone access laws increase access to naloxone among individuals who may be in a position to administer naloxone in the event of an overdose. And interestingly, despite that this type of policy directly targets a patient health outcome, there was only one rigorous evaluation of a naloxone access law included in our review. So we highly recommend researchers further expand upon this evidence. The second intervention included in our review that falls within this tertiary category are Good Samaritan laws. And these are policies that provide legal protections for individuals who contact emergency personnel in the event of an overdose. And there was one more rigorous evaluation of Good Samaritan laws as compared to naloxone access laws. One looked at hospitalization and one looked at overdose. And so for that reason, we couldn't really synthesize the effects of GSLs across the different outcomes. And so similarly to naloxone access laws, this is an area where we really need more research on the patient health effects of these policies. And then the final intervention type that fell within this category of tertiary prevention policies are policies affecting opioid addiction treatment. And this is a very wide category, all thematically related because the policy in some way affected treatment for opioid use disorder. So for example, that policies mandating insurers cover certain treatments for opioid use disorder, changes to public funding for treatments, et cetera. And interestingly, despite the many different types of state policies that could fall within this category, as well as the relatively high number of articles that assessed policies affecting opioid addiction treatment, there was also only one rigorous study of these type of policies. So again, another area where we need some more research on the patient health effects.
Well, that certainly is a lot of food for thought for researchers. Based on your review, which policies should state policymakers pursue first?
I'll start by saying there is no one-size-fits-all solution to address the opioid crisis across the country. State policymakers really need to look at the epidemic in their state and figure out what policy solutions are most appropriate for their particular population in their jurisdiction. And then secondly, state policymakers will likely have to implement several interventions to address the myriad of outcomes that they may want to improve upon that relate to opioid misuse. That being said, as I said earlier, there are several policies that appear to reduce opioid prescribing, those being drug supply management policies, robust prescription drug monitoring programs, and these combined interventions that include law enforcement, pharmaceutical, and public health approaches. However, as we said in discussing where we need some future research, if state policymakers implement these policies, we highly recommend they monitor some of the potential unintended effects. In regards to patient health and patient behavior-related outcomes, our review provides a little less clarity on which interventions are going to improve upon these outcomes. And so, as I said earlier, this is an area where we really hope researchers concentrate their efforts to provide some more insights to policymakers. And Rebecca, I'm not sure if you have any additional insights here.
It's not a one-size-fits-all approach. And so a policy that works in one jurisdiction may not be as apposite or appropriate for another jurisdiction. So to take a concrete example, our review showed that many of these policies, particularly robust prescription drug monitoring programs, drug supply management techniques, do reduce prescribing and dispensing of opioids, including that which is high risk. But some places don't need to do that anymore, and they've made significant progress there. New England states come to mind. There are other areas where they have not budged the needle quite as much, you know, or their cresting of prescribing happened a bit later, and they have not implemented quite as many policies. Some of the Midwest and Southwest states come to mind there. That's where we say it sort of depends on the state and it depends on their goal and what they need to do to mitigate the harms of their opioid crisis at this stage. We need to be thinking about not just the opioid crisis, but how it fits into the larger drug policy landscape and the drug ecosystem, because we are seeing harmful effects of a number of other drugs right now, including benzodiazepines, methamphetamines, and cocaine. The rates of overdoses with these drugs are increasing rapidly. We also know that when they're co-used with opioids, that's a particular harm. And we don't really yet know what the relationship between those drugs are and what policies might help address that. So I think we need more research there, and then policymakers need to have that on their radar. A lot of these evaluations can look at policies discreetly, or even does a state have a policy or what are its features? But what they rarely do is think about the contextual factors that might affect success. So by that, I mean, for a prescription drug monitoring program, for example, is there adequate funding for the program? What is the staffing for that program? How much outreach and education was done to prescribers? How much buy-in do they have in the programs? Those things all seem to, in some states, have a big effect on how much the program is used, what its effects are. But we don't have a good way of measuring that and really thinking about some of those factors. It's very time intensive and laborious. So thinking about how do we better get a handle on that, and maybe qualitative methods are the way to go, which we didn't really cover too much in our study, but thinking about what are some of those contextual factors that might affect whether a policy is successful or not at achieving its intended outcomes. And then also thinking about what are going to be the scale-up costs of implementing these policies. Like, those are things that are real-world issues that often are not tackled in an academic study, but need to be considered.
You both have made compelling arguments for more research in this area, especially evaluations of state-level policies. But let me ask this question. Is there a role for the federal government here?
Absolutely. The federal government can complement well what the states are doing. In terms of the opioid area, I've thought of the federal government as a little later to the table in terms of actually aggressively implementing policies. But then in recent years, they've been doing more and more. But I think there is still room for growth. A couple of concrete examples. The Controlled Substances Act is the main piece of legislation that regulates our controlled substances flow and monitoring and all of that in our country. I think opioid litigation is highlighting a number of ways in which the Drug Enforcement Agency perhaps was not enforcing that law as aggressively as it could have, and some actors may not have been in compliance with that law. So I think further enforcement of that, so that we know, particularly for prescription opioids, where the flow is, where there might be oversupply, those sorts of issues. The federal government also has played a leading role and needs to continue to do so in funding. They're funneling money to the states, for example, through the state opioid targeted response grants, and then the states have flexibility with what to do with that money. But a lot of the dollars are coming from the federal government, and so that needs to continue. But just for a frame of reference, the federal government has now put tens of billions of dollars into this crisis, but estimates suggest that it's costing our country about $100 billion a year, or about $1 trillion since 2001. So the amount of investments is not on the same plane as the costs of the crisis. So I think, and I've always advocated for much more funding from the federal government here. They also are a leader in payment and incentives for the workforce, particularly on addiction treatment, and continue to play a role there. You know, an example might be further incentivizing buprenorphine waivers, reducing restrictions on opioid treatment programs, those sorts of things. That is all regulated at the federal level. So they have a role there. Finally, I think the FDA, Food and Drug Administration, has played a large role here and has gotten a lot of criticism over the years in terms of too easily approving opioid analgesics, for example, and then also not doing enough to incentivize innovation on the treatment side and keep costs down by having generics on the market, for example, for opioid use disorder. So there are, you know, they've made some progress here for sure. They have now adopted a different framework for reviewing opioid analgesics that is going to use public health endpoints in addition to like sort of individual patient endpoints in determining approvals. They're also going to require that opioids are superior to other treatments if they're going to get approved for the analgesics. They've also said they're going to increase their risk evaluation and mitigation system program for certain drugs, some fentanyl-related prescription opioids. But I think they still could do more and be a little bit more aggressive there, and particularly in encouraging innovation in this area, both in terms of other pain therapies, but also in terms of addiction treatment. to make sure we just have more options on the market for people. And that could address some of these unintended consequences as well. Lastly, I would say, I think a place that the federal government really can play a huge role where the states are a little less situated is in terms of the illicit market and entry. And they can partner with states, but they really have more levers at their disposal in terms of controlling the flow, the inflow of illicits into our country and really cracking down on manufacturing within our country as well.
In closing, I'd like to thank you both for sharing your insights with us today and for your research contribution to the Milbank Quarterly. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.